Machu Picchu to the donuts of the deep dead sea. Let me set you straight, my friends, it always seems to be. Mammals, fish, and reptiles all taste the same to me. Chip beef on toast, half a friend for pot roast, tender little piggy toes with a bit of Bordeaux, French fried mince pies right between the fish eyes, half baked pound cake, shaking, making rattlesnakes, slop, flop.
Tastes like chicken.
Gruel, drool.
Tastes like chicken.
Spumoni, bologna.
Tastes like chicken.
Tastes like chicken to me. Quattro formaggi in an ancient Tuscan palace. Mystery meets impaled on...
Good morning. This is KBOO 90.7, and you are listening to The Food Show. We're in the studio with...
My name is Bruce. Good morning.
And I'm Kate. Good morning.
And I'm Miriam. Good morning.
I'm Arlise. Good morning. That
seems
like
we got a taste. We had a taste just now of The Food Show famine.
Aha, uh-huh, that's right.
We used to call that dead air.
Kate, you're going to start today, right?
I am. In October, we attended the Wild About Game event, which paired area chefs with game producers to showcase farmed game. Chefs who participated in the cook-off chose from a wide variety of ingredients to create a game dish for the judges. Cookbook authors were available, and vendors offered samples of their products. Also, ranchers and chefs paired up for cooking demonstrations. It was quite a day. In the following piece, you will hear the sounds of the event, including a live piano performance by Jim Fisher. Here we are at Wild About Game. Let's see what's cooking.
It's a very classic French dish. We have a pot-au-feu, and it's a fillet of elk that I poached in a stock with some vegetable and some foie gras and some cabbage. And I took these stocks and clarified it and made a consommé out of it. And serves a little vegetable with that, and serves the elk poached on top of the foie gras. And that's it. My name is Philippe Boulot.
What other kinds of game do you cook?
We have rabbit, we have partridge, we have elk, venison, squab, and sometimes we get game from Scotland, whatever true game we can get.
True game? You say whatever true game. What do you mean?
In Oregon, you can't serve a true wild game, so you serve a farm-raised game. And if it comes from Europe, you serve a wild game from Scotland. That's the only source of true wild game.
And how is it different?
It's gamey. The naturally raised game here is good, but it's mild in flavor. And the wild game is pungent and very gamey.
Are you a hunter?
Yeah. Actually, I'm going hunting right now. I'm going on the Deschutes River, so I'm going to fish for steelhead.
Do you enjoy eating those wild games more than the farm-raised, or does it not matter to you?
There's a rule. If I fish and I catch, I eat my catch. And if I hunt and I kill something, I eat my kill.
He said that in Oregon, we don't eat truly wild game.
There's no wild game being commercialized, period. In market or in any restaurant.
So if a hunter came to you with an animal that he had killed, would you buy it? Would you not buy it? What goes into your mind when you have this possibility?
I would not touch it at all. It would not even come through the door of the restaurant. It's illegal to buy wild game.
Pheasants.
I'm Mary Jo Bergs with McFarland Pheasants. We're located out of Janesville, Wisconsin. And our birds are an all-naturally raised birds, no antibiotics, no growth stimulants, and no animal byproducts in the feed. So they're raised on an all-vegetable diet.
So are your pheasants free-range, or do they have a specific diet?
They have a specific diet, but they are raised in free-roaming barns. We do have some outdoor flight pens that they're raised in. A flight pen is a big pen that has netting all the way around the outside and over the top to protect them from hawks.
Is it different than the flavor of a wild pheasant?
To a degree it is, because the fact that they don't have to travel quite so far to get their food, it really is going to affect the tenderness of the bird, so our birds are going to be more tender than the true wild bird, but I think you're going to find the flavor is very similar.
What's the typical dressed weight of the animals?
Our birds range from about 2 pounds to 4.5 pounds. they are taken as young adults, so taken at about 16 to 18 weeks.
I'm Marianne Veliquette, and I'm a rabbit grower in Klatskanai, an hour and a half northwest of here. So tell us a little bit about your rabbits. What's their life like? Generally, if they're market rabbits, they're 12 weeks of age. When they reach about 5 and a half pounds, they're raised on organic rabbit feeds.
Is that corn-based?
It's alfalfa-based. I use a specific brand that has no chemicals added into it. It's a pellet. It's an 18% protein. They're ready to breed at about 5 to 6 months, and they will produce 4 to 6 litters a year. My average litter size is 9 to 12 babies. The rabbit business keeps us hopping.
My name's Stephen Odom. I'm with Manchester Farms. We do about 6 million birds a year now. They are farm-raised, hormone and antibiotic-free. It's a lot like venison in that you don't have to cook it like a poultry or turkey. You can cook it to medium. We do about 120,000 birds a week now.
What's the typical dressed weight of the quail that you sell?
Dressed weight, we average around 5 and 5 1/2 ounces bone-in.
If you're farming, it's not wild anymore, is it?
Well, it's a wild species of birds, and there are different species of quail. There are a lot of wild species that you can't grow in captivity because they are so susceptible to a couple of diseases. Specifically with quail, what most people shoot or hunt in most areas of the country is a bobwhite. But it takes a longer time to grow. It is more susceptible to diseases. The species that we grow is a farrow. It is naturally disease resistant, which allows us to do the hormone and antibiotics freeze. What most people grow bobwhites for nowadays is for hunting plantations. They hunt them, sell them live, sell fertile eggs so that they grow them and release them on plantations for shooting.
When you raise quail, do they get to eat natural things from the ground and from their environment?
Ours are not free range, which is typically what you're talking about. It is a corn-soybean diet, so it is all natural ingredients. They're not pen-raised, but they're raised in like chicken houses, so they're what we call litter-raised. But they don't go outside and eat insects and peck on the ground on what you might consider a true wild bird or a free-range bird that you might grow.
I was wondering how that might affect the flavor.
Most of the game meats that you're going to find, whether it be the quail, pheasant, venison, are not going to have as gamey of a flavor as you would in a wild bird.
I love game. I am actually also an upland game bird hunter, so I love to get out there. You know, the adage, you are what you eat, is true of most game animals, so you get a lot more consistency in product that you would buy from commercially available game. Occasionally when you're out hunting, you'll get a bird that has been eating sage grass or something like that, and it has a very pronounced sage flavor, so much so that you can hardly eat it. You certainly don't get that with commercially available game, which is a huge benefit.
If you're accustomed to eating a wild bird and then you go eat a farm-raised one, how does that compare?
I've never done a side-by-side with my wild game versus a commercially available. What I have done, however, I had quail and dove that I had hunted, and I had friends over for dinner, and I didn't have enough, so I had to substitute some store-bought chicken. And I was absolutely blown away. I'm a fan of chicken. I love chicken. And compared in flavor, though, there was almost no flavor. I cooked them the same way. I used the same marinade on everything. And we did a mixed grill, and we were all absolutely amazed at the increased flavor that you get from the game birds. Animals that are more akin to their wild cousins or wild definitely develop a richer, deeper flavor than something that's been completely farmed for a long time, like chicken.
You are the judges.
My name is Janie Hippler. I've written a book called Wild About Game, and so I have the great honor of being the head judge today, and it's very, very, very difficult when you have almost all the best chefs in the Pacific Northwest competing in this competition. We're all trying not to eat too much because we know how hard it's going to be with 19 competitors.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be looking for?
Well, the most important thing, of course, is taste. It has to taste good. And then originality and plate presentation. So it's fairly simple judging, but overall it's just the kind of thing that if you went out to dinner at a restaurant, you'd want to order it over and over again. Today we have wild boar and buffalo and Roosevelt elk and venison, and it's a challenge to judge.
How did you learn to taste and eat game?
Well, I grew up in Northern California, in a very rural area. Hunting was a way of life there. And I just grew up eating actually good food, both wild and farm-raised. And
you know what real wild game tastes like, and you're eating a lot of farm-raised game. How does it compare?
They're really completely different. You know, we were just discussing actually with the other judges, it's a very fuzzy line between wild and farm-raised. I mean, we're going to eat buffalo, and I mean, it's sort of hard to think it's a farm-raised buffalo. They're on huge ranches. So, I don't know. I think that it's a fine line, but there is a difference, say, between farm-raised quail and wild quail, and they're completely different, but they're both equally delicious. And I've been married to Hunter for 40 years, and so for me, I like farm-raised game because I always know what I'm going to get. There are no surprises in those packages.
My name is Jan Bjorgi, and I'm with Sierra Meat Company. It's a farm-raised New Zealand venison. It's free-range. It can eat whatever it finds out there, little acorns or anything on the ground, and lives a very happy existence in New Zealand. We import it into the U.S. and we distribute it throughout the states.
Why would an American want to essentially go all the way to New Zealand for venison when it lives here?
It has a very, very different flavor profile. A lot of people are afraid of venison because it's gamey tasting. This is not gamey tasting at all. It's based on what they're eating over there and also the slaughter practices. It's called cervena, which is a word that the New Zealand government came up with, meaning certified venison. And it's like certified Angus beef in this country. So to qualify, it has to be a certain age, has to be raised in a certain manner, it has to be slaughtered in a certain manner. To be called cervena, and this fits that bill. So there's a lot of different reasons why it tastes different, but the bottom line is it does taste different. It's not gamey flavored at all.
What's your favorite method of cooking venison?
Salt and pepper, and grill it to medium rare.
Do you find, are people more inclined to cook venison than they were even just a few years ago?
Absolutely. Yes, they are. You see it more and more on restaurants, fine dining menus. And I think when people go out and they have it at a restaurant, they think, I want to try that at home. So, yes, it is a growing trend.
At Mother's, we stick more to the more approachable cuts of meat, things like pot roast and chicken, unless Dad brings home the deer.
You know.
So when Dad brings home the deer, how do you prepare it?
I specialize in slow-cooked food, so I would be more apt to make a stew or a braised dish, maybe a pot au feu like Philippe did, more than I would a quick sear.
Do you have any experience cooking wild game as opposed to farm-raised game?
A friend of mine shot a squirrel once.
And you cook?
And I cooked the squirrel, you bet.
How did you cook the squirrel? I sometimes think that someday when we're really short of food, we can eat squirrel.
You know, there's lots of them around, that's for sure. This was actually out in the woods, and I think I stewed it, if I remember correctly.
How did it taste?
A little gamey.
Was there enough meat on it to get a taste?
Yeah, for the two of us, we had a taste. That was about it.
And that's pungent and gamey. The event left me with a question. Is game game? Like Judge Hibbler, I ate the game that my father and his brothers hunted. In generations before, hunting was not game, but a main source of food. It is illegal to buy true wild game, except the fish from the oceans, which, by the way, is wild game. As I strolled from vendor to vendor tasting their products, I was repeatedly presented with farming practices that raised my flags. Is 10,000 quail any different than 10,000 chickens or ducks? What impact does grazing wild game have on the wild populations of birds and animals that are becoming popular farm animals? Is game game? Most states prohibit the sale of game, the exceptions being in New England and some southern states where game suppers are common fundraising events for churches and local fire departments. The game suppers in Vermont are something I took for granted growing up there. Wild fish is the last hunted creature that is legally traded around the world. Farming fish is not always healthy for wild fish. The dangers of farming fish vary from species to species. For example, farming salmon is not good, but farming oysters is good. In Alaska, farming salmon is illegal. Montana and Wyoming laws restrict elk farms. In Oregon, the Supreme Court recently upheld a decision to ban canned hunting of captive non-indigenous deer. This is a hot issue right now. A herd of farmed elks escaped from their enclosure on a farm in Idaho, threatening the wild elk population. The concerns are about spreading disease and genetic purity. Apparently, these elk farms are breeding shooter bulls, that is, for so-called canned hunts that yield supersized antlers. The governors of Montana and Wyoming have asked Idaho to ban the farming of elk. The controversy rages on internet blogs and diners across the Northwest. To learn more about cooking and eating farm-raised game, the USDA offers an extensive fact sheet on their website. That's www.fsis.usda.gov. Recipes for cooking game can be found at www.nickyusa.com. That's NICKYUSA.com. These websites will be at the front desk after the show. And next month, Alice Cascorby will return to the food show to update us on wild seafood.
Thank you, Kate. Well, the food show crew has been considering some uncommon foods lately. By uncommon, we mean foods that are not often eaten by white Judeo-Christians in Portland, Oregon, USA. We just had our second report from the Wild Game Show, Wild About Game Show, and in a moment we'll visit a Chinese restaurant where they serve some things I've never seen on a menu before. Also, two books have come to us recently which really test our open-mindedness, our sense of adventure. One is called Strange Foods by Jerry Hopkins. It covers such things as insects, some birds, and mammals, and some animal parts that you may not have considered to be edible. But all are eaten by somebody, some cultural group, of our fellow human beings. Now, we're not doing this to gross you out, though there may be a few times when you will say, ooh. But remember that there are many ways a form of life becomes a food. First of all, it is available. Second, someone tries it and lives. Third, it works its way into the culture. That is, a way of preparing it becomes common knowledge, and society places a value of some kind on it. These steps will always be true, whether it is a hamburger or an apple or a guinea pig. If you are adventurous, go to the restaurant that we went to, Wong's King, at 87th and Southeast Division, and look at the well-illustrated menu. If you want to learn more about uncommon foods, here are some resources. The book called Strange Foods by Jerry Hopkins. It gives history, lore, and dining tips for a wide variety of foods, and it is well-illustrated. There's a new book called Fierce Food, which covers many of the same foods. Again, history and lore, but thankfully, no photos. What the author, Krista Weil, does offer are classifications for the foods she discusses, such as spiny, eating may cause pain, disease, or death, incredibly smelly, has eyes, aphrodisiacs, and tastes like chicken. Again, That's Fierce Food by Krista Weil, spelled W-E-I-L. Books specifically about insects are as food are listed at the following website, www.food-insects.com. And again, we'll have all these websites and references at the receptionist desk after the show. And finally, this news from London, England. A restaurant that served such delicacies as bullfrog, piranha fish and chips, rattlesnake spring rolls, and lots of different insects has closed. It was called Edible, and the owner, Todd Dalton, is continuing with his import business. One of the leading products is mealworms from South Africa and South America.
Thank you, Bruce. I haven't had breakfast yet, so that's really thinking about those things. This is the KBOO Food Show at KBOO 90.7. And stick around at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, an interview with Jordanian immigrant Osama Awadalla, who was acquitted of federal charges Friday that he lied to a grand jury investigating the September 11th attacks. And now Miriam is going to talk more about her experience at a local restaurant and uncommon foods.
Yeah, in looking at unusual foods, the food show took a trip to Wong's King Seafood on 87th and Division, but just as I anticipated, none of us were ready to try the chicken paws. So I went back to Wong's, and I spoke to Fu Wong. He's a very affable general manager. We started off our conversation by talking about why a chicken's head often accompanies its body when a whole chicken is ordered in a Chinese restaurant. Here's Wong's King Seafood General Manager, Fu Wong.
The chicken, we do keep the head on it too.
What is that in Chinese culture? Why do you keep the head on?
It has head and tail, has beginning, has ending, so it's a good luck thing.
Oh, really? Mm. Okay. So if you have something without the head, it's not...
There's no beginning, and maybe there's an ending, but you got to have a beginning, you know? The head stands for beginning. The tail stands for ending.
Okay.
If you know what I mean, it's like a good luck thing, you know? It's cultural. Yeah, really cultural. It's really bad luck without the head.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you eat the head?
I don't eat the head.
Do some people?
A lot of people do. In matter of fact, I ate the squab before, the head.
You did?
Yeah.
Well, did it taste different than the regular meat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It must be really, I don't know, is it bony or...
Well, you got the skull. You get the brain, you know, texture like tofu, you know. I don't know if really I want to tell you because you might not want to eat tofu anymore, you know. Next time you eat tofu, you might be thinking about the skull brain.
Oh, gosh. That's okay. When someone orders here a chicken, let's say a Caucasian person comes in, do you ever have any reactions that the people are like, ugh, when they see the head? Is that ever a problem?
Once in a while. The girls, you know, kids, even adults too, they think it's kind of gross. Some of them, because there's the eyeball, you know, there's a cheek, you know, there's a head just cut off, you know.
So what do you do in that situation? You just take it away, or do you explain it? Or?
Well, I mean, you know, we can take it away and take that. A lot of parents just take it and put it in the wrapper themselves.
Okay.
But the next time they come, they're very smart about it. They say, please leave the head and the legs off, you know. Yeah, or the butt.
What do people order here? Do they order the same things that they know generally from other Chinese restaurants? They order.
Yeah, American people come here, they like to order things like, you know, like the original, sweet and sour chicken, you know, the chop suey style, that's what we call it. And when they come here, we try to recommend, more exotic, more authentic type of food for them.
What would you recommend someone who says, okay, I'm tired of ordering sweet and sour chicken, I want to try something new, but maybe I don't want to, eat the head. Maybe I want to not eat that event.
There's 150 things in our menu, almost everything freshly made, and we don't make it unless you ordered it.
Okay.
So if most of the time, whatever you see in the picture is whatever you're going to get.
It kind of looks like that?
The reason we put this picture here, because so people can see there's a head or not, like this one here, you can see the head.
Okay.
This one, you can see the head. Mm-hmm. This one have no hair, so you don't get to see the head. This one, it has the head. Mainly the chickens, like this one, let me see. Mainly the chicken has the head. And the fish has the head.
Would you say on the chicken, let's say of 10 or 20 people who are ordering the chicken dish, how many would eat the head? Is it more usual or more unusual to eat the head?
More unusual to eat the head.
More unusual. Mm-hmm. Does, in Chinese tradition, does the head have give you any special, something special? Is it supposed to help you with certain things if you eat the head? Is it, you know, is it make you smarter? Or does
No, it doesn't have any kind of meaning? Like, some people, I mean, we might find 10 people that who like to eat the head, they all eat the head. But we might find 10 people that don't like to eat the head or they don't even eat the head, like for me. Okay. If I take a chicken home, more likely no one's going to eat the head because we don't like the head, you know. But if we take it to my grandma's house, she's going to eat the head because maybe she likes the texture where the neck is. You know, I have no idea, you know. You don't really like to see the head on, you know. It's kind of sad you see this head here, you know. But the thing is,
for Americans, it's very unusual because when you, if you order duck,
because when you order chicken, you only get a chicken breast,
right?
Which is the best part of the meat is not the chicken breast. Maybe the more healthy part of the chicken, you know. And to me, the best part of the chicken is the wing, you know. The whole part of the wing into the arm and into the body, you know.
Uh-huh.
That's what my favorite part is, you know. Like, the meat around the wing is so tender, you know. Or the rib, you know.
So let's say you get an adventurous American customer. Someone comes in and they're a little bit nervous. They may want to try something new, but they're not really sure.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. We have a lot of people highly trained that for special people like this, because this is America, you know. To introduce your food, you gotta have somebody good to tell them, you know, don't be scared and blah, blah, blah. So we start with the, because if you know the beginners, we start with not the super exotic, more like a good looking dish, you know, like our hair, you know, things like this.
What would you start with?
I would start with this dish right here. It's called the honey walnut prawns. It's the dish. It's the most. This prawn is, I don't really consider the Hong Kong style, but it's a very classic. We sell a lot of this, and nobody ever complained before.
Okay. So there's no skin on this. There's no eye.
There's no shell. It's a very creamy sauce. It's a little crunchy, and those sweet walnuts is unbelievable. If somebody gonna come to my place, I would recommend, if they like prawns, I would recommend them this one first, and then.
But this, let me stop you there. Doesn't seem so adventurous. How could someone try, or maybe you don't recommend for an American person to try something like pig stomach or to try chicken paws? Is that something that is maybe too much for them, or?
I have a lot of American friends of my own. I invite them to come over for dinner a lot because I need some good opinion and suggestion from Americans. So maybe I can detune some of the dishes. For a lot of Americans, yeah, you cook it that way, but not so heavy in flavor, so you can just test it out, you know? So like this one here, chicken paw, I mean, a lot of my friends try it. They say, you know, it's not as bad as I thought, but I wouldn't order it by myself.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people tells me that. That means, I mean, it's chicken leg. I mean,
it's the feet?
The feet, yeah, the feet.
But there must be no meat on it. It must be all bones.
Yeah, it's just skin and bone and fat and tendons.
Is this a popular dish for Asian people?
For Asian, for Hong Kong, Vietnamese. The chicken paw is like a popular dish.
Oh, okay. Is it considered a fancy dish?
Mm, no.
No? Just regular food?
Yeah, I think people shoot for the texture more, the taste of the texture, you know.
Is it like chicken wing?
No.
No.
It's like the tip of the chicken wing.
Okay. Oh, it's tough to eat then, though.
It's not tough.
No, but there's a lot of...
The way we cook it, it's so soft. It just melts in your mouth. And then you get these little bones that you have to spit out, you know.
Oh.
It's pretty interesting, you know. You might have to try it yourself to...
Okay, your American friends, before they ate it, were they like...
They were a little scared. They were a little frightened. They're like, they think it's sick.
They think it like maybe be poison or something? Or?
Not poison. They think it's... like one of the guys, I would start laughing. He goes, oh my God, that's like baby hen, you know. And that really frightens me, you know. I said, you're going to be okay eating it? I don't want you to eat it and go home and have a nightmare about it or come back and sue me or something, you know. You know, for me scaring you. You know, so...
So what else have they tried?
They try...
Have they tried the pig stomach?
They tried the pig stomach. They don't like it. They try...
What didn't they like about it? The taste? The texture?
The texture. Well, the matter of fact, they think it's a stomach. you know.
Well, it is a stomach, isn't it?
It's a stomach. it's a totally stomach that holds the fixed food when they eat.
Okay. Anything else that they tried that was maybe a little bit different? Pork intestine, have they tried that?
The frog legs.
Okay, the French eat that.
The frog legs, they're not really into... They think eating frog is like really sick. Cause when you look at the frog, you know, they think they're eating the frog like that, you know. But this frog leg, like, you basically don't see the frog, you know. You know, and
they tried it though.
They tried like this thing here, goose feet. You see?
That is
a delicacy.
Oh really?
Yeah, and it's low in cholesterol because of the skin. It actually the tendon. It's not a fat. Actually.
But they tried it.
Yeah, they tried it. They actually don't think it's too bad, you know. But like I say, it's not a dish that they want to order by themselves.
Do you have Americans who come in and order this? Or?
Yeah, Americans are usually they've been in China before.
Okay.
Or they came from San Francisco or New York. They tried it before. They like it.
Okay.
But I do have a couple American friends that tried it. They like it. But like I say, they like it doesn't mean that they have to eat it by themselves, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but if a group eating it, they'll eat it again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so from all these dishes that we talked about, the pork intestine, the goose web, the pig stomach, or the chicken paws, which would be the easiest for someone to try as a first one?
I would try the chicken feet.
The chicken feet?
Yeah, because if you can try the chicken feet, you will try everything else.
Why are you so sure?
Because most of my friends, they think the chicken feet is the worst thing they can ever try in their whole lifetime. Someone will have to put like a knife in their face, like, hey, may you eat this right now? Some of them really don't want to eat. This one lady, this girl, she actually, please, can I not eat that? I said, you're my friend. You're here for to test my food out, you know, to give me expensive opinions, you know, please. She goes, no debating. So she eat everything else. At the end, we make her poke a bite of it. And then she goes, it's not too bad. And then she spit it out. you know, it's not too bad. I'm not a very good chopstick guy.
Oh, come on. How could you not be a good chopstick guy?
He's a fork at home.
Oh, come on. You do not. You do?
It's a little bone from the leg.
You look like you eat this pretty well, though. That was... I must tell you, I'm a little afraid to try it.
You see it?
Yeah. I will try it, though. But
take a bite of the leg.
Now, what do I do?
Just pick it out and just take a bite of anything.
That part?
Any part is okay. Be brave.
Oh, it's really bony.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to pick it up.
It's really hard to pick it up.
Would you like to use the fork?
No, it's all right. It's just it's really bony.
Yeah, the whole point is like put all the bones in your mouth. Yeah. It's okay.
It's okay.
I think you're a very brave person, you know. You're going to have a lot of good food to you.
How is it for you? Are you insulted?
I feel bad because they don't born in China. I'm born there. I had it before. It's a cultural thing, you know. Like, you know, what do you call the snail in the French food? You don't call
escargot.
Snail.
Escargot.
Escargot, I'm sorry, yeah. To some country, they think it's nasty. Not till they eat it, it's so good, you know. Just like the chicken feet. You're thinking about it, it's like, oh, man, you know. But after you eat it, but ooh. Because we do have a lot of Americans eat that too.
Of all sort of the different foods that you have, is that the one that they try the most? More often
often because like on dim sum, they have it every day. But I never found myself insulted. I will never do because you don't expect people to eat everything. You know, not things that they grow up with, you know. In dim sum, Hong Kong style, and you don't call yourself Hong Kong style because you don't have any chicken feet. And without this item, it's not real culture. Just like eating hamburger without French fries. Even in some countries, you think French fries is death to them. You know, even in our country, people think French fries is death. It's the beginning of the death row, you know. Some people think pizza is sick, you know, but to me, pizza is a wonderful thing.
Well, I just had to end on that note. Here we have Fu Wong, the general manager of Wong's King Seafood, extolling the virtues of pizza. Mr. Wong says he likes everything about pizza, the cheese, the sauce, the crust. He and his children also like French fries. But he told me when he first came to America in 1989, he thought mayonnaise was disgusting. But he eats it now, and sometimes he eats it together with tuna fish. And sometimes he even has tuna with mayo on bread for breakfast. Now that's a testament to his ability to culturally adapt. How many of you out there are going to try the chicken paws? So hats off to Fu Wong. I got to say it, but those chicken paws were a real leap of faith for me. I'll tell you that much.
I was going to say hats off to you, Miriam, because you tried those chicken paws. I only looked at them.
I brought them over to Kate's, actually, afterwards, and couldn't get her to try them. My kids wouldn't try them.
There's also something about the environment, too, in which you try the food.
Well, yeah, and I have shellfish allergies, so I wasn't certain that I wanted. I didn't know exactly how they were prepared, so I didn't take the chance. It was a great excuse.
Yeah, but I also thought it was really big of him. You know, he said that people, when people said ew or yuck or whatever, that he just took that in stride. He said, you know, they're not born in China, they don't have my background, they don't have my culture, and you know, that's okay. Whereas I think, you know, the other way around, people might be offended, or, you know, if you went to a Thanksgiving dinner and you didn't know what, you know, turkey was or whatever and didn't want to try that, I don't know, people here might be a little bit ticked off or not as accepting, at least. I thought he had a really good attitude. So on that. But I got to tell you, you know, some of the things on the menu are very, very different.
What were some of the other things that you...
Well, you know, the whole thing with the, you know, when we started off the piece with the head, with the chicken, I think that can really turn a lot of people off to have, you know, a chicken come out with the head. And I actually have been to China a couple of times, and the first time that happened to me, I must admit I was, you know, really taken aback. It's just something you're not really used to. You know, they had a lot of an intestinal type things, you know, different body parts that we don't necessarily look at. But I did think that what was good about their menu was they did show you pictures. It was very pictorial. You know, when we went to the restaurant, we did see that. So
yes, and it's fully bilingual, too.
Yeah.
And the waiters and waitresses are pretty helpful. With some of them, there's a bit of a language barrier, but they're very helpful. They understand, as Fu Wong does, that people are going beyond their usual bounds here and are a little nervous.
Yeah, I did think, though, his approach was good, you know, to get people out of the sweet and sour chicken prison, you know, that nice. People are just so used to. They go to Chinese restaurants, they always order the same thing, and, you know, even that first dish, I mean, some people can't eat shrimp, but, you know, that it's something a little bit different, you know, maybe a different sauce, different meat, different, you know, background type thing, that that was a really positive thing, that to try to get people to stop ordering the same thing all the time. So, but, you know, you have to make that move yourself. You know, I'm not saying everyone should go there and order chicken paws, but, you know, maybe next time you're at a Chinese restaurant, try something that you haven't ever had before, you know, that may be culinarily acceptable to you.
And you can eat it with a fork.
Yeah, I thought that was hysterical. He said he's not good with chopsticks. It was a little hard to understand there. And I said, why aren't you good with chopsticks? He said, you're kidding. He said, we use a fork at home. I said, no, you don't. I was like shocked at that. So he's actually quite Americanized. So, you know, I did break down and use the fork on the chicken paws. They were impossible to pick up with the, for me at least, with the chopsticks. They were just really sort of very, very, I don't know, very difficult to deal with. But anyway, I did try them. So
good for you.
That's great. Yeah. I really enjoyed that piece.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Kate and I actually had another experience with some foods that were maybe not as strange to us, but unusual.
Right.
We went to One Green World, a place that we've been to before, and the owner, Jim Gilbert, has been on KBOO, also on The Gardening Show. It's a nursery and importer of food plants, mostly fruits, and they had an open house a few weeks ago. And at the time of year when many fruits are ripening, and they were serving some very interesting things, both as fresh fruit and some as juices. What was your favorite, Kate?
Oh, the pawpaw, of course.
Pawpaw is imported from the U.S., actually.
Imported from the U.S., but he told some stories about going to the southeast of the United States and gathering pawpaw seeds because he propagates those by seed. Didn't he tell us that? I'd have to look back at my notes to be certain. But I had never tried pawpaw, and I always wanted to because I know that it is an old native food in this country, and I loved it. It's sort of like this vanilla cream pudding and a fruit. It's really good. But there were a lot of unique varieties of
berries of all kinds.
And berries of all kinds. And then we went on a tour, and this One Green World their business is actually to sell you the plants, to plant in your garden or whatever, in your yard. So many of the fruits that they have on their trees that were ripe, they use for the seeds, or they're just, you know, sort of the byproduct of not everything, but many of them is the byproduct of their operations. So I ate so many wonderful pears, and you know, you just kind of grab this fruit off trees and eat it. Kiwis and pears, they're my favorites too. How about you? What was your favorite?
Well, I like the pawpaw, and I have had it before. The seeds in it are large, but it's worth working around them for the custard. You said vanilla, but I find it a little more lemony, a little more fruity, but the texture is wonderful. It's worth the work.
Definitely. And he had some goji berries that he showed me, the goji berries. And
many of the fruits he had were from Russia and other former Soviet republics. There were some from Latin America, just all around the world,
All over the world, yes.
Yeah.
It was great. I loved it there.
One other possible adventure for listeners, food that most of us have probably had, tamales, but there's going to be the first annual Tamale Festival coming up on December 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. That's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Clackamas County Fairgrounds in Canby. And they're going to be serving 40 varieties of tamales made fresh right there. Chicken, of course, and pork, but also Dungeness crab and a Greek tamale with goat cheese from Alcee Acres, and on and on. And this is sponsored by the Canby Asparagus Farm, which you may have seen at farmers markets. They'll have a chef from Oaxaca, Mexico, who's an expert in this. And there'll be some other activities for the kids and adults, too. And admission is they ask for a can or package of food, which will be donated to charity, to the hungry. I don't know which one. I hope it's a certain one, which you'll hear in a moment here on the food show. But again, that's the first annual Tamale Festival, December 1st, 2nd, and 3rd at the Canby Fairgrounds.
And I also went to another festival over on Saturday, just a couple days ago. I went to the Vegan Holiday Festival, and I will be bringing you more about that probably in December. I'll do a little report about that. But it did happen, and it was very exciting. It was the first ever. Lots and lots of people attended, and the organizers were very happy with the response there. So congratulations, guys.
Yeah, I wanted to go to that. That must have been fun. Now we're going to switch over. We have Jean Kemp Ware here. She's from the Oregon Food Bank, and we will be talking about Oregon and hunger, and we're going to take a music break. However, before we do that, just wanted to ask you to stick around to the KBOO Food Show.
Jean, come on over here.
Blackberry winter comes without a warning, just when you think that spring's around to stay. So you wake up on a cold, rainy morning and wonder what on earth became of me. Blackberry winter only lasts a few days, just long enough to get you feeling sad. When you think of all the love that you wasted on someone whom you never really had. I'll never get over losing you, but I had to learn forgotten song, till a blackberry winter reminds me you are gone.
All right, we're here with Jean Kemp Ware from the Oregon Food Bank, and in our break you were telling a story.
Yes, I remember as a child, one of my favorite foods was brain. But I never associated it with the mind. I just learned to eat it before I ever knew what that part of the body was, and I loved it. And it was a real treat for us. We only could eat it at the wintertime because it needed to be fresh. And so, but I remember it being a real treat, so I think it's all what we get used to.
What kind of animal did it come from?
I think it was probably a calf brain. If I recall.
That's interesting.
We had a little diner that was just pork brain and fried, and my dad would always say, come on, let's go down and get the brains from Bruce's Cafe. And I don't know. Good. Well, we're going to move into a different subject now. Jean, you're from the Oregon Food Bank, and you've been on KBOO a couple of times, and also you have been interviewed during the Blues Fest.
Right.
Several times, because when that benefits the Oregon Food Bank. And I thought it would be interesting if we could talk about, now we're in the season, Thanksgiving and Christmas and Hanukkah and all the giving seasons. This is a very important time of year for you.
It is an important time. And it's, if you think about it, it's really been since the Blues Festival when we were able to really fill up those shelves. And so this is a time when we come to the people, the public again, to say, you know, we need your help. And so we're hoping that people will step up and help fill up the shelves so that people can have food on their table.
Mm-hmm. And now you have a facility. The food goes to the facility, and it becomes a shelf. And then what happens? Does it get into boxes? And can you explain to people what happens?
If you think of a wagon wheel, Oregon Food Bank is the hub of a wagon wheel. We collect food, and then we distribute it through a network of 20 regional food banks to every county in Oregon, plus Clark County in Washington. And then those regional food banks distribute it to a network of almost 900 hunger relief agencies. So the food that gets distributed through Oregon Food Bank reaches people throughout the entire area. Every month, in an average month, about 200,000 people eat meals from an emergency food box, and about 72,000 of them are children who have no choice, no voice. And we still have a long ways to go to eliminate hunger.
Mm-hmm. You talked about filling up the shelves. How empty are the shelves now at the food bank? What does it look like?
Well, last year we had a dip of 26% in USDA food. We were down last year, during the last fiscal year, 3 million pounds of food. Over 2 million of that was from a dip in USDA.
Now, can you explain that? I don't think
U.S. Department of Agriculture gives us, it is a farm price support program. And, Oregon Food Bank and other food banks across around the nation are beneficiaries of that food that is excess, but helps to maintain the price supports of the farmers. This year, the market is good, which means that food isn't coming in. It's usually very shelf-stable food. It comes in nice family-sized packages. And so that's what we need. We need good, nutritious, shelf-stable food to help. We're looking for other sources to help make up for that. We expect that the USDA product will never be up where it was at one time. At one time, it was maybe 40% of the food that Oregon Food Bank received. Now it's like 15%.
What kind of food are you talking about?
We're talking about basic kinds of things like flour, raisins, soups, stews, pasta, tomato sauce, So what we're asking for now is for things like that, especially things that are high protein. Peanut butter,
beans.
Tuna fish, beans, stew, vegetables, fruits, things that are canned, things that you can put together to make a meal.
Okay, you talk about soups. It's not like someone could make something and bring it there, correct?
No, we cannot handle things that are homemade or things that are in glass, things that have been opened. So if when we receive those things, we have to throw them away, which is actually a cost for us. So we ask you to please be careful about the kind of food donations that you give.
Does that happen much, that people make things?
It does. It happens occasionally. I saw it just recently where we really had to throw away a bag that someone had brought in, which was too bad.
Mm-hmm. You wanted to talk about some of the numbers, maybe, of hunger and some of the typical causes that you talked about a study when we spoke on the phone long ago. Could you elaborate?
Every 2 years, the Oregon Food Bank Network does a survey of emergency food box recipients. And so this survey involved almost 4,000 emergency food box recipients. And then we compare it to see what's happening and who is hungry and why they are hungry. We saw two trends this time. One is that more people have jobs, but they are low-wage jobs, so they can't afford to feed their family. And we saw that more people are without health care. So, for example, almost half of the recipients had at least one person in the family who was working. But because of the high cost of housing and fuel and childcare and medical costs, people just can't make it. So you might have people sometimes even working 2 and 3 jobs, and they're trying to cobble enough money together to keep a roof over their head, and food does not have a landlord. It doesn't have a bill collector, and that's usually the last thing that people get to paying.
And do you know how this has changed over the years, and also how do we compare to other parts of the country here in Oregon?
A ranking was just released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture last week, and we've gone from number one in the country to 22nd, which you can say that's great. And we know that that was only because of the work of so many people coming together in Oregon. We increased the amount of food in the emergency food system. We increased our outreach for food stamps. We increased our other outreach programs and put other programs in place. We increased our advocacy. So all those efforts help, but when you've got 200,000 people who can't provide food for themselves every month, we still have a huge problem.
So what are some of the things that people can do in this season, but also how can we help throughout the year and in May and in July and, you know, to keep the shelves stocked?
Well, right now we have a major food drive happening. It's called Fill the Bag. And so you can drop off food at any Albertsons, U.S. Bank, or Jiffy Lube. Jiffy Lube, if you bring in 5 cans, they'll give you $31 off of your oil changes. So that's to make it very convenient for people to be able to do that. We also, right now, we're looking for volunteers for our Fresh Alliance program. That's a program that deals with with perishable product. And we need people who can come regularly every week for a few hours. That's a big commitment on people's part, but we really need that. It's one of the last untapped sources of food. And we encourage people also to donate. For every dollar, Oregon Food Bank can distribute 6 pounds of food through its food distribution program.
That's very interesting. The fresh food program, what would the people actually be doing?
There, every day our trucks go to retailers such as Albertsons and QFC and Fred Meyer, and we pick up perishable products such as milk, meat, deli, food that is past its sellable date, but before it's still usable. We can, in 24 hours, we can put that on the table if someone is hungry. We need people to examine every single solitary piece, item that we receive, make sure it's okay, and sort it out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's a commitment that people can find out about that by calling the food bank and also going to your website. Could you give us that number?
www.oregonfoodbank.org. And we appreciate this.
And what's your number there? Or who do they speak with? And
they can call 282-0555, and that's our general number, and we can put you in touch with people who can help.
And I have a question. What's the favorite, or maybe the top five favorites on your list of foods that work well, that people enjoy eating, that you need? Do you have any?
Peanut butter.
Okay.
Peanut butter is so nutritious. Peanut butter, tuna fish, and pasta and tomato sauce. Those are the kinds of things, and beans.
Okay.
So those are good foods, and those are the kinds of foods that we don't get from other sources. They're not the kinds of things that are excess in a store.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much, Jean, for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And we are also thankful to you for joining the food show. Miriam, thank you for your piece. Kate, I'm glad that you went to the Wild About game and have such input on the show. Kate is coming on in. And encourage folks to go visit Wong, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's fun. He's had
a
fun place.
He's hilarious.
Great. And join us next month. We are going to have another food show on the third Monday of the month at 10 a.m. And have a great day.
With your belly aching and bubble, saying you can't afford your grub, saying a dollar ain't a dollar no more. Tell me, buddy, what's new? You say you can't afford bread no more. Well, this ain't no charity store. Say your kids are hungry too. I got good news for you. You can eat dog food. You really ought to try it. You can fricassee it. You can deep fry it. Flip it on over. Cook it anyway. Eat along the Rover three times a day. Well, it comes in a bag or a can, perfect eating for a working man. If you're down on your luck just now, it'll get you through the day. But if you eat it in the afternoon, you might feel like howling at the moon. Buddy, you're complaining too soon. This is all I got to say. You can eat dog food. You really ought to try it. You can fricassee it. You can deep fry it. Flip it on over. Cook it anyway. Eat along the Rover three times a day. Yes, ma'am. Not as fat as cereal.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. In Mexico today, November 20th, is Revolution Day. The people of Oaxaca, Mexico, are engaged in a struggle to build a popular democratic government there. They now face a repressive occupation by federal military police forces. There are several actions happening today related to this issue. At 3 p.m., Oaxaca Solidarity Rally, Pioneer Square in downtown Portland. At 3:30, march to the Mexican Consulate, which is at 1234 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. At 4 o'clock, a letter will be delivered from the OCIMO, the Organización de Comunidades Indígenas Migrantes de Oregon, to the Mexican consulate. At 4:30, a caravan will leave from the consulate to Picun's Radio Revolution event in Woodburn, Oregon. from 6 to 9 p.m. today, Picun's Radio Revolution, celebrating KPCN-LP, their new low-power FM station. Picun, 300 Young Street, Woodburn, Oregon. And also from 6 to 9 p.m., Oaxaca Resiste, Education Night. Join Oregon Oaxaca Solidarity for an evening of film, music, and a personal account of Oaxacan resistance. Guadalupe Perez will speak about his experiences as a member of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, APPO. Liberty Hall, which is at 311 North Ivy Street in Portland.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Stand up! Get up! You can say it again!
Go!
Get up! Stand up! Get up! Get up!
So wrong.
Get up! Stand up! Pass up! All right, come stand up!
University police repeatedly shock a UCLA student with a taser gun after he refused to show his ID in a school library. The student, an Iranian-American, was handcuffed the entire time. The incident was captured on video and has sparked outrage across this campus and the country. We'll speak with the Council on American-Islamic Relations, calling for an independent investigation. But first, a Jordanian student arrested after 9/11 is acquitted of perjury. We'll talk with Osama Awadallah and his attorney. And we'll remember Dr. Mike Alkaly. He lived with AIDS for more than 20 years. He died this weekend of leukemia in Oakland, California. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The CIA has reportedly found no conclusive evidence Iran is seeking to develop nuclear weapons. In a new article for the New Yorker magazine, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reports a secret CIA draft assessment has challenged White House assumptions on Iran's nuclear capabilities and complicated efforts to build momentum for a military strike. A former senior intelligence official said Vice President Dick Cheney is leading the charge to discount the CIA's view. The official said, quote, they're not looking for a smoking gun. They're looking for the degree of comfort level they think they need to accomplish the mission. Cheney's also said to have told a White House meeting 1 month before the midterm elections a Democratic victory would have little effect on the administration's decision to go to war. Just last week, Israel's outgoing ambassador to the U.S., Danny Aiello, told an Israeli newspaper President Bush will not hesitate to use force to stop Iran's nuclear activities. In Iraq, more than 110 people were killed in violence around Iraq Sunday. At least 17 died and 50 were wounded in a suicide attack in the town of Hilla. Meanwhile, insurgents kidnapped Iraq's deputy health minister in what's believed to be the highest level abduction of an Iraqi official to date. In another major development, Syria's foreign minister was in Iraq Sunday for the first visit by a Syrian minister since the U.S. invasion. The foreign minister, Walid Mualem, offered Syrian assistance in battling insurgents and called for a timetable for withdrawal of foreign troops from Iraq. In other Iraq news, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has said he believes a military victory for the United States is impossible. In an interview with the BBC, Kissinger said, quote, if you mean by clear military victory an Iraqi government that can be established and whose writ runs across the whole country, that gets the civil war under control and sectarian violence under control, I don't believe that's possible, he said. Kissinger's advised the Bush administration during the Iraq war. Human Rights Watch is calling the recent trial of Saddam Hussein fundamentally unfair. In a new report released today, Human Rights Watch says the trial was undermined by interference from the Iraqi government and failure to allow an open hearing of evidence and witnesses. President Bush is in Indonesia today as he continues his eight-day tour of Asia. More than 10,000 people took to the streets of the capital, Jakarta, Sunday, ahead of the president's visit. This is Al Nurdin of Indonesia's Islamic Defenders Front.
Various elements from different Muslim civil organizations here have all objected to the devil himself, George Bush, coming to Indonesia. Essentially, we all agreed that Bush is a murderer in the eyes of Muslims across the world.
Protests are continuing in Indonesia today. Meanwhile, a coalition of American human rights, labor, and religious groups are asking President Bush to refrain from promising further assistance to the Indonesian military. In a letter organized by the East Timor Action Network, the groups write, quote, "We are deeply troubled by ongoing human rights violations by Indonesia's security forces, especially in Papua, and its widespread impunity for crimes against humanity and other serious violations committed against the peoples of East Timor and Indonesia." Last year, President Bush issued a waiver on a congressional restriction on military assistance to Indonesia. In the occupied territories, the Israeli military called off a planned airstrike in Gaza on the home of a wanted militant Sunday after hundreds of Palestinians gathered at his home to protect it. Hamas activist Nizar Rian described the scene.
In the beginning, hundreds of people gathered, and in less than an hour, there were gathered on the roof. Now the men and women are taking shifts, meaning the morning, and said, "We will be here during the day, and you cover during the night." Now our sisters sitting on top of the roof rest inside the house.
An Israeli spokesperson called the Palestinian action, quote, "a cynical exploitation of our attempt to avoid harm to civilians." But Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh said the tactic had broken new ground and would be used to stop future Israeli attacks.
Israel will not break our will, and we will stand together for a long path, starting by what has happened here today at this house, to protect our house, our children, our women, and our elderly.
In Kenya, a UN summit of environmental ministers wrapped up Friday with promises to take action on climate change in the future. The summit said it would review the Kyoto Accords in 2008 with the possibility of agreeing to further cuts in greenhouse gases. Under Kyoto, signatories must keep their emissions to at least 5% below their 1990 levels before the year 2012. The summit also agreed to fund African initiatives for clean energy. Many African leaders and activists, including Sharon Lurmenta of the Maasai community, said the conference had failed to address Africa's needs.
You came here to look at some climate impacts and some poor people suffering, then climb your airplanes and head home. Africa is sometimes called the forgotten continent, and it looks like you have forgotten us.
In Sudan, the UN's top humanitarian official has once again been barred from visiting Darfur. Jan Eglin, the UN relief coordinator, was forced to end his trip Friday after Sudanese officials stopped him from entering villages housing Darfurian refugees. Eglin spoke after returning to the Sudanese capital of Khartoum.
"And never would I have thought that the fear, the angst among the civilian population of Darfur would remain the same after 3 long years.
Here in the United States, up to 22,000 people gathered outside Fort Benning, Georgia this weekend to call for the closing of the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas. 15 people were arrested after crossing the line onto the base. The U.S. military has used the school to train many Latin American and Caribbean military officials accused of abusing human rights. Protesters heard from a number of survivors of U.S.-backed regimes, including Maria Guardado of El Salvador.
They had me bound and blindfolded.
Me quemaron que después de 26 años todavía tengo señas de las quemadas.
They burned me in such a way that now, 26 years later, I still have the scars of.
This was the 17th year of the School of America's protests. The weekend actions are timed to coincide with the anniversary of the November 1989 murders of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter in El Salvador. According to the organizers, protests also took place in Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, El Salvador, Paraguay, and Peru, as well as in Ireland, Canada, and other cities across the United States. On Capitol Hill, a leading Democratic Congress member has announced plans for legislation to reintroduce the military draft. New York Democrat Charles Rangel, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee come January, says he believes mandatory conscription would deter politicians from launching wars. Rangel said, quote, "There's no question in my mind that this president and this administration would never have invaded Iraq if members of Congress and the administration thought their kids from their communities would be placed in harm's way." A new study of hundreds of hearings where Guantanamo prisoners were deemed enemy combatants has found the U.S. military called no witnesses, withheld evidence, and reached speedy verdicts usually within a day. The study was overseen by Seton Hall professor Mark Denbow and his son Joshua. Both represent Guantanamo prisoners. The hearings were held before a panel of three officers with no defense attorney present. Out of nearly 560 prisoners, all but 38 were ruled enemy combatants. And finally, two military veterans and a Catholic priest have been sentenced to prison time for staging a disarmament protest at a North Dakota missile silo last June. The men dressed in clown suits broke the locks on the site using sledgehammers. They painted the word disarm and poured some of their own blood on a silo lid. The men called themselves Weapons of Mass Destruction Here Plowshares. The three were each ordered to pay restitution of $17,000. The oldest of the group, 73-year-old priest Father Carl Cabot, was given the longest sentence of 15 months. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, Jordanian immigrant Osama Owadalla was acquitted of federal charges that he lied to a grand jury investigating the September 11th attacks. 10 days after the attacks, Owadalla, who was then a student at Grossmont College outside San Diego, was taken into custody and held as a material witness. Agents detained Owadalla after they found a scrap of paper with his name and telephone number in a car at Dulles National Airport in Washington, D.C. The car belonged to Nawaf al-Hazmi, one of the 9/11 hijackers. Osama Owadalla spent much of the next 20 days in solitary confinement, where he was treated as a high-security risk. He was released on bail in November of 2001 as he awaited trial. Owadalla's case was thrown out once, reinstated by a federal appeals court, then delayed for almost a year while prosecutors tried unsuccessfully to have the judge removed because of claims of bias. When the case finally reached trial earlier this year, the jury ended in a deadlock. Until Friday, Osama Owadalla faced the possibility of 10 years in prison and deportation. He joins us in the studio now, along with Sarah Kunstler, an attorney on the case. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Okay. How did it feel to have those verdicts of not guilty repeated over and over again on Friday? How many times?
It was 27 times of saying not guilty. And each one after another was just, an indescribable feeling of how, justice is being done in my case. Well, I cannot describe my feeling, but I knew I were innocent, and I knew in this great country that justice system is good enough in order for me to be acquitted, and the jury were great, and it happened. I just, was so happy and was waiting for that, final verdict of the 27. When they said not guilty, it's like, mountains were removed out of, from my back, and it's just like a newborn, new life to me.
What did you do next? Was your family in the audience?
My father was in the audience. Was the first one that I greeted and hugged. And then I greeted my lawyers, and we just waited so I can go and thank the jury and, you know, speak with them and see how they felt. And it was just amazing.
Sarah, this was not the first trial. Can you explain the series of trials?
Well, this case was initially the indictments were thrown out by Judge Shira Shinlin. We went to the first trial in April of 2005.
And the indictment at the time was?
The indictment was reinstated. It was two counts of perjury with 27 specifications. And in 2005, the government appealed a pretrial ruling and stalled trial basically right after jury selection. It took another year for that appeal to be resolved. And April of 2006, we proceeded to trial again. In that trial, it was 10-1 to convict Mr. Abdallah. It was a hung jury with one holdout juror who had reasonable doubt as to his guilt.
Now, explain the perjury charges. Why originally was Osama arrested and charged with what? What is the whole story of the grand jury for those who aren't familiar with it?
He was arrested, he was originally questioned because an old phone number of his was found in a vehicle belonging to one of the hijackers who flew into the Pentagon. It was actually a phone number that hadn't been his for over a year and had only been registered in his name for a 2 or 3 month period a year before. He was brought in for questioning and shortly after arrested on a material witness warrant, which the government can use to detain people who aren't, when there isn't probable cause, when they aren't charged with crimes, solely to bring them to testify before grand juries when it's determined that there is a probability that they won't go on their own voluntarily on subpoena. So he was brought to New York, treated as a high risk inmate, and kept in solitary confinement, subject to ill treatment, the hysteria of 9/11. The guards who held him in custody didn't know whether that he was a material witness. They didn't know if he had ties to the hijackers. They didn't know if he was partially responsible for 9/11. All they knew was that he was being detained in connection with the 9/11 investigation.
So, Osama, how did they treat you?
Well, you want to take it one period of it, you know, at a time. On September 20th, I was coming back from my school, heading to my home to take a rest, and I have another class that I want to go back to. And here I was surprised with 6 or 7 cars parked in front of my apartment. 20 FBI agents approach me, and it's like it's like if I have done something. That I was shocked, you know, for all these people to come, and they start, you know, questioning me, are you Osama Abdallah, and all these questions, and they show them my ID and said, okay, we need to talk to you about, you know, ask you a few questions. Then I said, okay, well, just go to my apartment, do something, and, you know, come out. And actually, I wanted to go and use the bathroom. And the FBI agent refused to close the door on myself. And that's, in my religion, it's very important, it's very serious that, you know, when you are doing some private stuff, no one intervene or anything. And that was...
He refused to allow you to close the bathroom door.
Yes. And that was the spark or the first incident that made me start to be confused and, you know, afraid and all these, you know, surroundings even around me. Since that time until the last day of grand jury, which is October 15th, it was just a series of mistreatment, unbelievable, ridiculous treatment in a way that a human being cannot be treated. And then we went to the FBI office. They questioned me for about 8 hours.
Did you have a lawyer?
Constantly.
Present?
No, I didn't have a lawyer. They told me it was going to be a short time. You don't need anyone to be with you. You're going to be fine. Just, you know, a few questions, then you will go home. I said, it's fine, you know. And remember, at that time, I'm 20 years old, you know. My English at that time is not like what I'm speaking with you right now. It's completely different, you know. It's been only 2 years in the country, or a year and a half, and...
Was there an Arabic speaker there?
No, there wasn't an interpreter nor an Arabic speaker. Then they questioned me all day until 10, 11 midnight. And I was so exhausted that I just wanted to go home. I even was going to answer whatever they want just in order just to get home and, rest. My family didn't know where I am. Everyone was worried. My community were looking for me. And I came at 11 o'clock. I went to my brothers, and there I told them what happened with me. And the second day, the FBI... Well, actually, on that day, on September 20th, they asked me that they want to come on the next day to continue questioning. I said, well, I've just said everything that you want. You know, I have. Why this other day? They said, well, there's a couple of questions we need to verify. I said, okay. Then the second day at 6 o'clock in the morning, they came to my apartment, and I drove with them. I told them it was a Friday, and there was the Friday service, and I told them I have to catch my Friday service, so I hope this won't take much time. I said, no, yeah, no problem. Then we went there. They started confronting me with things more, you know, in a more high tone than the previous day, and they started jumping me. This time there were four people who's asking me questions, not like one. You know, it's like you have a person in there and you have four people asking you questions at the same time. So you have to answer this. All this pressure and stress that, you know, came in, then at the end they said, you know what, I guess you're going to go to New York right now. Right now we're going to put you in a plane and ship you to New York, just like this. And from there, you know, continued, went to MCC jail and then Oklahoma, I think San Bernardino, sheriff jail, then they took me to Oklahoma jail, then ended up with New York. And until then, that's all that happened.
And they were questioning you about your knowledge of two of the hijackers.
Correct. And well, not about two of the hijackers. General questions about, you know, who do you know in the community? Yes, there were some specific questions about, you know, people that regarding two of the hijackers, but that came later more extensively. But at the beginning was more of general questions. Whom do you talk to? Who are your friends? Do you know these people? Do you know if, you know, they were doing or intending to do anything like that?
When you were brought before the grand jury, you were in handcuffs?
Yes, I was.
We're going to go to break and then come back. We are speaking with Osama Odala and his attorney, Sarah Kunstler. Stay with us.
Cáscara, pega, mata e come. Cáscara, vai morrer de fome. Cáscara, mais coragem do que homem. Cáscara, pega, mata e come. Cáscara, lá no sertão. É bicho que a voa que nem avião. Ou é pássaro malvado, tem vivo volteado que nem gavião. Cáscara, quando vê roça queimada, sai voando e cantando. Cáscara, vai fazer sua caçada. Cáscara, com vinte é cobra queimada. Mas quando chega o tempo da invernada, no sertão não tem mais roça queimada. Cáscara, mesmo assim não passa fome, os burrego que nasce na baixada. Cáscara, pega, mata e come. Cáscara, vai morrer de fome. Cáscara, mais coragem do que homem. Cáscara, pega, mata e come. Cáscara, é malvado, é valentão.
Zalia Barbosa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this exclusive interview, we're talking with Osama Awadalla, the Jordanian student who was acquitted on Friday of federal charges that he lied to a grand jury investigating the September 11th attacks. He joins us in studio along with his attorney, Sarah Kunstler. So you were
handcuffed before the grand jury. One of the jurors, after the trial on Friday, after the verdict was read, said that were particularly disturbed about how you were treated. Why were you handcuffed during the grand jury testimony? Were your hands behind your back?
No, it was handcuffed to a chair and the grand jury. But, you know, this came along, I mean, from a long process of, you know, using all the shackles and handcuffs. It wasn't like, you know, this was actually the easiest that, you know, I had, you know, in terms of handcuffing. But he used to have the three-piece suit, what they call a three-piece suit, where my feet were shackled and my waist connected to my hands.
That's called the three-piece suit?
Correct. Why they handcuffed me in the grand jury? Well, first of all, they treated me as a high-risk inmate. And they told me on San Diego that you are a material witness. But that did not came to be true. It came like they treated me as even one of the hijackers, as if, you know, a person who has so much great danger to the community and to the people around him, as if I am a criminal, you know, things like that. And when they took me to the grand jury, they were afraid that I might do something or harm the jurors or the grand jury that were sitting in that room, or I might flee. I mean, I'm surrounding with 10 marshals and handcuffed and been all this solitary confinement all these 20 days, and they still think, and they know I'm a material witness. But because of what happens and the situation we're around at that time, everyone was angry, and they justified their abuse to me by relating, oh, we're having such a hard time these days, and it's complete security, and so it cannot be justified in any way, but that's what, you know, they did.
Sarah Kunstler, what does it do to a grand jury when they see the person testifying in handcuffs?
We actually tried to get the indictment dismissed when we found out that Mr. Awadallah was handcuffed in the jury room, on the basis that seeing him in handcuffs prejudiced the grand jury against him, because it made them afraid of him. It made them suspect that he was guilty of something already or capable of violence. It's terribly prejudicial for a grand jury to see a witness come in handcuffs. It suggests all sorts of things about that person.
And let me add up, this handcuffing me to the chair was one of the main reasons that I was answering those weird questions on the grand jury. They had so much stress in me. That's one of the reasons. There were other reasons, but this one was also, you know, contributed to me forgetting the answers and, you know, being under stress, being nervous and afraid. All these things, they have added up into what I have said in the grand jury at that day. And that's how, you know, the government did it. You know, they played it right, and that's what happened then.
The authorities allege that Osama Awadallah knew Nawaf al-Hazmi, who helped seize the plane that crashed into the Pentagon. But the two perjury counts stem from two statements he made to the grand jury regarding another hijacker, Khalid al-Midar. Explain those charges, Sarah.
Those charges were based on Mr. Awadallah's inability to recall the second man's name when he was being questioned in the grand jury. Mr. Awadallah was able to describe this second man. He was able to accurately recall how many times he'd seen the second man, the extent of his relationship with the second man. Unlike Mr. Awadallah had actually met Nawaf al-Hazmi on several occasions and knew his name.
You knew him from San Diego, from the mosque?
Yes.
But he had no interactions with the second man. He had seen him accompanying Nawaf al-Hazmi and may have been introduced to him, but had no personal interactions with this other person.
And why did they charge him with perjury? Because of the name, remembering the name?
They charged him with perjury because at one point he had known this other man's name. And when he appeared before the grand jury after 20 days of being shackled and chained and beaten and abused, when he testified before the grand jury, he was unable to come up with the second man's name.
The jury forewoman, Alma Weinstein of Rockland County, said the panel wasn't convinced the statements at issue in the case were of any importance to the terror probe. Were you surprised by the verdict, Osama?
Well, I wasn't surprised so much. Yes, there was some surprise to it, but I knew myself. I knew I were innocent. And this time we have changed the way we picked up the jury. We were more careful of, you know, things of what to ask and how to interact. And it's been 5 years since September 11th, and people will never forget, you know, such an event. But I think I believe that I would be acquitted in both counts. I didn't have a doubt that this couldn't be happen. I knew it would happen, but I still had some, you know, like fear of, you know, some people might not leave their feelings alone and regarding September 11 and put this away and just try the case solely on what happened on that days without just relating to what happened to, you know, feelings and their friends and their experience with September 11. That was my only fear and doubt, but I had a 90% belief that the jury will, the indictment will be acquitted.
And what are your plans now?
My plans is now I'm going to continue my master.
What are you getting a degree in?
Well, I had a degree now in information system, and my master will be a doctor, as a medical doctor, and then maybe get married as soon as possible, and just, you know, look for the best job or, you know, find a good job and just continue into my life.
And you will stay in this country?
Absolutely.
And Sarah Kunstler, how typical is what happened to Osama Awadallah?
You know, unfortunately, I think it's more typical than we would like to believe or would want. You know, I think the test of our civility is how we treat people in those moments after tremendous tragedies like September 11th, and it's at those times when maintaining your When treating people well and giving people the presumption of innocence and not criminalizing people because of who they know and or how they look or what they believe is most important. And if Osama's case teaches us anything, it's that we need to be careful, very careful in those moments on how we pass judgments on other people and how we treat them.
Sarah Kunstler, thanks very much for being with us. Sarah also is the daughter of William Kunstler, the famed attorney, a late attorney, also based in New York, and Osama Awadallah. Did you want to add one more?
Yes, thing? I just want to say another thing. This case was very important, not just only for me, for thousands and thousands of people who have been through my situations. You know, I've been treated so badly that bring the image of how our government here in the United States act with people, you know, in a such a way, in a harsh way. There were many people in this country waiting for this case, and I hope the government would rethink the way they interact with prisoners or material witnesses or those people who have been held up for nothing, you know, just and I would thank all those people who stood with me, you know, starting from my lawyers, people in San Diego, people in my country, and I would like to thank all of those who prayed for me, and I wish good for everybody, and I wish nothing such a thing would happen again to anyone else.
And the advice you would give to someone caught up in the same situation that you were, now that you've gone through it all of these years?
Well, if someone is in my situation and they still, you know, I would say have patience, and there are people for you staying, you know, or outside, you know, calling for justice, and also people have to be careful of whom they're dealing with, you know. You know, I learned my lessons, and
in what way? Careful
in,
who you're dealing
in,
with?
In what way? In knowing who you deal with. You know, sometimes you might not be able to distinguish between a good person or a bad person, but it's good also always to be more careful, you know, and just...
Are you talking about the authorities or people in your community?
Well, both. Both, especially the authority. I mean, the authority always... I mean, and the way it happened with me, they seemed so friendly to me at the beginning that then they turned out to be, you know, like monsters against me. And they come and even testify in my court completely different of what happened and of what how they talked to me, how they treated me, especially, you know, those FBI agents that they tried, you know, to question me. So be careful. Always have a lawyer with you. Never, never speak with someone without having someone with you who knows the law, know everyone should know that he has a rights in his country, in this country, and he should use them to his best extent.
Osama Owadala and attorney Sarah Kunstler, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
As we move on to our next story today, officials at the University of California, Los Angeles are launching an independent investigation into campus police officers' repeated shocking of an Iranian-American student with a taser stun gun. The incident took place last Tuesday evening in a UCLA library filled with students studying for their midterm exams. The student, Mustafa Tabatabanejad, a 23-year-old senior, was in the library's computer lab. The campus police ordered him to leave after he failed to produce a student ID. Police then handcuffed Mustafa and shocked him with a taser gun at least five times. The entire incident was captured on video by another student and has been widely seen on local TV news and the website YouTube. In the video, Mustafa can be heard screaming, "I said I would leave," after police repeatedly shock him with the taser gun.
I got tased for no reason. I was leaving this godforsaken place. You stopped me. You're abusing your power. Here's your justice at work, University.
Stand up.
You just shot him up. You just
stand up.
Stand up. We're going to get tased again.
Stand up. Get up. Get up. Stand up.
Go. Do that.
Stand up.
Get up or you get tased again.
Go.
Get up. Stand up. Get up.
Go.
Mustafa was stunned at least five times. That video you can see on our website at democracynow.org for our radio listeners. Mustafa's attorney, Stephen Yagman, said he plans to file a federal civil rights lawsuit accusing the UCLA police of a brutal, excessive force as well as false arrest. He said Mustafa initially refused to show his ID because he thought he was being singled out because of his Middle Eastern appearance. Mustafa is of Iranian descent, but a U.S. citizen by birth and a resident of Los Angeles. Meanwhile, more than 200 UCLA students marched to the university police station Friday,
calling for an independent investigation and the suspension of the officers involved. Hours later, the university announced a veteran L.A. law enforcement watchdog would head up the probe. Merrick Bob served as staff attorney for the Christopher Commission, which was formed to examine allegations of excessive force in the Los Angeles Police Department after the Rodney King beating in the early 90s. Hassam Ailush joins us now on the telephone. He's executive director of the Southern California Council on American Islamic Relations, which has also called for an independent investigation. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you explain what has developed from this point as of Tuesday when the attack took place?
Well, when we first received the report of the attack from various students on campus, you can just look at the, you know, we're getting have the picture by listening to it today, and the same thing with your listeners. It's only when you watch the video that you feel how the full extent of how disturbing the imagery is. We were extremely disturbed, and we immediately called for an independent investigation because we felt that such a disturbing incident requires an impartial review and probe. Since then, the university announced an internal review that will be conducted by their own University of California Police Department. But I think after the actions taken by the students on campus, led by the Muslim Student Association there and many supporting groups from Latino groups to African American groups and various social justice groups there, I think the university realized how serious it is. I could say the whole community is shaken by it, not only the student body, but even the parents, the whole community, because we as parents and the community send their children to the university thinking it's a safe place. This is not a way to treat a student. I'll tell you how what I heard from parents. People are saying, yes, maybe Mustafa was a little bit obnoxious, maybe he wasn't too compliant. We don't have the whole picture, actually, but based on what we've heard from news report, it seems, yeah, maybe initially he was asked for an ID and he didn't show the ID. But he never showed any violence. He was never threatening to any of the officers or anybody else. So if the goal was to detain him, to hold him, there were enough officers at that time to hold him and handcuff him, but there was no need to use the taser on him.
Looking at an article from ABC News, quoting the University of California Police Department Assistant Chief Jeff Young, telling the ABC News affiliate KABC-TV, I think we need to focus on the actions of the person, not just what you're hearing on the tape as far as the words. He refused to identify himself. He had refused to leave the library. And he also, when he was escorted by the officers at first, he went limp, which is a form of resistance, Young said. Hassam Ailush, your response.
Well, again, we only have the images from the video to determine what really happened, plus the eyewitnesses' account. And it's too early to make a judgment, a final complete conclusion on what happened. That's why we demand the investigation. But just judging by what we see someone who's resisting. But according to law enforcement, because I do work with law enforcement people, and all of them said, this seems to be, because there is a differentiation between resistance. There is something called passive resistance, which is going limp like what Mustafa was doing. And there is active resistance, where you start pushing around and trying to harm somebody else. And according to the policy of all police departments that I work with, including the sheriff departments also, tasers should not be used when the person is involved in passive resistance. What they say, the policy is, tasers should be used against persons who are actively resisting or to prevent those individuals from harming themselves or others. In this case, it's very, very clear, at least from the video itself, Mustafa was involved in neither. He wasn't actively resisting. He was passively resisting, and he was never threatening anybody, nor seemed to be threatening anybody. So, now, according to them, it seems like the policy, that's what the gentleman had been saying in media, is that the policy for the UC Police Department actually is more flexible than the rest of the police departments in the area, and that is, it allows them to use the taser's technique, pain-inducing weapons, against students or against individuals, even if it's not active resistance, which is extremely concerning because That means they're allowed to use brutality against students on campus at a time when the larger police department dealing with real criminals outside has more restrictive policy. So if that is true, if that is the case, then there's certainly a need and a demand to change that policy.
We're talking to Hassam Ailush, Executive Director of Southern California CARE, that's Council on American Islamic Relations. Four of UCLA's nearly 60 full-time police officers recently won taser awards given by the manufacturers of the electronic shock device to law enforcement officers, quote, who save a life in the line of duty through extraordinary use of the taser. This according to the Los Angeles Times. We come back. I want to ask one more question on this issue, then talk to you about CNN's Glenn Beck's comments when he was interviewing the first Muslim member of Congress. Stay with us. That's Fad Gadget, Ark of the Aorta, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking about the teasering of Mostafa Tabatabai Najad, an Iranian-American student at UCLA last Tuesday. And we're talking with the head of the Southern California Council on Islamic Relations, Executive Director Hassam Ailush. According to a study published in the Lancet Medical Journal in 2001, a charge of 3 to 5 seconds of a taser gun can result in immobilization for 5 to 15 minutes, which would mean that Mostafa could have been physically unable to stand when the officers demanded that he do so. The incident follows the recent announcement that four of the campus police the so-called taser awards, as I said before break, from the manufacturer. This is the last question on this issue before we turn to Glenn Beck, Hassam. But have you talked to Mostafa?
Personally, I haven't done so, but I know people on campus have done so, people we've worked with from the Muslim Student Associations and others. And I know currently he's not personally making any comments anymore since he has hired an attorney. What I want to add is on the issue of the taser itself very quickly, I think there was a recent study by the ACLU that shows that since 1999, 148 people have died as a result of the use of taser. So that really brings us to the really larger picture in the whole issue, and that is the use of such brutal tactics in the attempt of to arrest people. I think it also leads to the underlying issue, and that is the culture of violence that is sweeping our country and the world today, where we as individuals become so desensitized to the pain and the suffering of other people. And we witness this maybe in the arrest of individuals, but also we see it in what happens in the Abu Ghraib, in the Guantanamo Bay prisons, in the way the police brutality cases we hear, whether it's against Iraqi prisoners, against Afghani prisoners, or even against our own American detainees. And I think this should maybe be a wake-up call for us. And we need to change this culture of violence that is taking over.
Hussam Ailush, I wanted to turn to a second issue that sparked controversy earlier this month. On November 14th edition of a CNN headline news program, host Glenn Beck interviewed Keith Ellison, the Minneapolis Congress member who will become the first Muslim ever elected to Congress. He was elected, of course, November 7th. And this is an excerpt of the interview that Glenn Beck did with him.
I will tell you, may we have 5 minutes here where we're just politically incorrect and I play the cards face up on the table?
Go there.
Okay. No offense, and I know Muslims. I like Muslims. I've been to mosques. I really don't believe that Islam is a religion of evil. I think it's being hijacked, quite frankly. With that being said, you are a Democrat. You are saying, let's cut and run. And I have to tell you, I have been nervous about this interview with you because what I feel like saying is, sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies. And I know you're not. I'm not accusing you of being an enemy, but that's the way I feel. And I think a lot of Americans will feel that way.
Well, let me tell you, the people of the 5th Congressional District know that I have a deep love and affection for my country. There's no one who is more patriotic than I am. And so, you know, I don't need to prove my patriotic stripes.
That was the newly elected congressmember from Minneapolis, Keith Ellison, first Muslim to be elected to Congress in the United States, being interviewed by CNN's Glenn Beck. Hussam Ailush, your response.
Well, I would say that's why he won the election for Congress, because he's a diplomat. Probably he could hold his temper. If it was me, I would have said, I am extremely offended. What Mr. Beck did is nothing short of total bigotry. To question the patriotism of an American citizen who happens to be Muslim, because he's questioning the issues of Iraq, the failed immoral policies of this administration, is nothing short of pure racism and bigotry. And if this was tried on a Jewish person or a black person or any other person, he would not have to continue his show after that. Unfortunately, we live at a time where it is the only acceptable bigotry today, open bigotry, is the one against Muslims. No one has the right to question the patriotism of American Muslims. Someone who is born and raised in this country, such as a patriot, a true patriot, such as Keith Ellison. And it's a shameful thing, because if it's ignorance from the part of Beck, then that is shameful, but if it's something that is intentional, it's even more painful to us. And it seems this is something that that is going on for a while. This is not the first time Mr. Beck makes anti-Muslim comments. It seems that Mr. Beck is CNN's response to losing the bigoted segment of its viewers to Fox, and they're trying to win it back, and the way to do it is by bringing people like him to come and make, to use scare tactics, Islamophobic scare tactics.
Will CARE be issuing a letter of protest to CNN?
Actually, we're looking into it, not only from this comment. This was on our mailing. This was sent to our members when it happened, but also we're looking at a long list of anti-Muslim comments made almost on a daily basis on his show. Mr. Beck seems to enjoy focusing on the fringe elements within the Muslim extremist segment, forgetting about the existence of extremists in all religions and all groups, focusing on some the media shock or the shocking image of extremists, in a way to create this scare and fear of Muslims in America.
Well, Hussam Ailush, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Southern California Council on American-Islamic Relations. As we turn now to our last segment, longtime advocate and activist Dr. Mike Akley died on Saturday in Oakland, California. He lived with AIDS for more than 20 years. He died of leukemia. He was the Oakland director of the Cannabis Buyers Cooperative, a free medical marijuana clinic under Proposition 215. That proposition legalizes medical marijuana in California. Dr. Alkale lived with AIDS, was a medical marijuana patient himself, a pediatrician as well, a veteran. Mike Alkale was the founder of the Migrant Farm Workers Clinic in Watsonville, California, and had used his medical skills all over the world, including Britain, Germany, Kenya, Mexico, and Nicaragua.
This is Dr. Alkaly being interviewed 2 years ago for the Steppin' Out of Babylon radio series.
I see the medical marijuana movement as part of a much larger movement that actually is global now, and it has to do with economic and social justice. And most of it you're not going to hear in the corporate media. It's all below the radar. But anybody who's in these various movements, the tentacles are linking together. You know, Pacifica Radio is part of it. Air America is now a part of it. The Internet, in great measure, is a part of it. And we're coming together in ways that the other side doesn't even want to acknowledge or will do everything to stop. But we're in the great majority.
Mike Alkaly on the radio several years ago. He died this weekend of leukemia. Glenn Alkaly is Mike's brother. He's an anthropologist here in New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now! And condolences on the loss of Mike.
Thank you, Amy.
Mike was a remarkable humanitarian activist. I co-hosted, I think it was the 6th International AIDS Conference with Mike when he was, well, in the first years of his diagnosis with AIDS about, many years ago. He lived, he was so healthy for so long, it was remarkable.
Yeah, he was one of those medical textbook cases of a person living with AIDS, and he was actually in it from the very beginning. He was infected in 1986 and went through a lot of different trials. Every type of trial he was involved with. There was one famous one in Stanford. He used to commute down to Stanford twice a week for those trials, and then that eventually led to AZT. Actually, those trials, and so he's one of these survivors. Had been a survivor living with AIDS.
He was a remarkable communicator. Also, was the producer of the radio program AIDS and Focus for a number of years. Briefly summarize Mike's life for our listeners and viewers who didn't know him. For anyone who didn't know him, it's a loss.
Well, he was an incredible person. I'm a little biased here. My older brother. He after med school, went into the Army. That was the deal. He had to spend a year in Vietnam, so he was a captain and then eventually a major. Then he came back, lived in the Bay Area, and started a health clinic, as you mentioned, in Watsonville. And he actually had the idea of bringing down doctors and nurses to volunteer with the farm workers, the migrant farm workers in California. And he saw that the farm workers, though they were invisible, they were illegal, but their children's illnesses were not invisible. So he had the idea to set up in an old warehouse a clinic, exam tables, actually took a look at the children of the farm workers, that eventually turned into a very large clinic in Watsonville.
And then his activism, pediatrician, how did he get into radio?
That's a good question. He was always interested in video, film, media, radio. It was actually quite natural.
And the whole Cannabis Buyers Club.
Yes. He got involved with that about 12, 13 years ago or so. Actually grew Centimelia in his backyard in his Oakland home and distributed for free. Had written over 1,000 prescriptions, medical marijuana prescriptions in California, which are legal. So then he became the medical director for the Oakland Cannabis Cooperative.
And was a spokesperson for that right to the end of his days.
Yes, indeed.
He's survived by his two grown-up twin sons.
Yes.
And you and his greater community, family.
Yes.
What did Mike want to be remembered for?
That's a really good question. I think just all the people's lives that he touched.
He went down to New Orleans in January.
He was in New Orleans in January. He believes that's where he contracted the leukemia, uterine leukemia, a very rare, fast-spreading leukemia. And the two causes of that particular leukemia are radiation and benzene. He's convinced that he was exposed to benzene while he was covering a story in New Orleans in January. And then on top of his AIDS, his already compromised immune system probably exacerbated the leukemia.
The funeral?
There's going to be a memorial in January. And anybody who knew Michael in the Bay Area, please contact KPFA, the local station, Pacifica Station in Berkeley. They will have all the details. We haven't set the date yet, but in January.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Glenn, for joining us. You, who also have been a longtime activist around the issue of nuclear testing in the South Pacific, brought to the attention of Americans what was happening there with the French nuclear testing. And thank you for your work as well.
Thank you very much, Amy.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a transcript of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org or see any of the video footage that we brought you today. The Breaking the Sound Barrier tour continues around the country. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see where we're headed next. Also, my column by the same title is now being picked up by newspapers around the country, and you can call your local newspaper and ask them to pick it up as we take on issues that don't get picked up very much by the corporate media to break the sound barrier. Again, you can get information at our website, democracynow.org, where you can also see or listen to the broadcast for those who haven't gotten a chance to see it today. Tell your friends. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Peter Yoon, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Angela Alston, Uri Galed, Hugh Gran. Again, that website is democracynow.org, where you can also sign up for our daily headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
It is exactly 12 noon. You're tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM.